The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams. Chaos and catastrophe, by their very definition, don't repeat. But it is important to realize that there are different types and levels of uncertainties that we need to be aware of. It is not always about being rational or having a process in place. Being aware of our limit in what we are able to see and comprehend as possibilities is as important as planning. Indeed, in some contexts, planning might make us more vulnerable than improvising, as it exposes us to unintentional bias, write Dave Snowden and Alessandro Vancati. Today, I'm here with Dave, founder at Cognitive Edge, who designed a Quinarium framework and expertise sit at the intersection of knowledge management, complexity science, and system theory. Thank you, Dave, to be here with me, and welcome to the briefing today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Before exploring how to leverage the Quinarium framework in the context of decision-making, innovation, and futures, shall we firstly unpack the framework at a high level, describing it for those that are less familiar with?
Okay, so very high level position on this. First of all, Canavin is a Welsh word, so it's pronounced Canavin, yeah? And it's not the same as the German Heimat, which is a sort of look backwards. It's a sort of sense of being in a continuous flow of events, yeah, that you can't fully understand or control. So that's the meaning of the word. Canavin starts off by identifying three distinct types of system: ordered systems, complex systems, and chaotic systems. So ordered systems have a high level of constraint, so behavior is predictable. Chaotic systems, and chaos isn't used consistently across the discipline, so I'm using it to mean a random system, a system without any effective constraint or control. And then a complex system is one which is deeply entangled. Everything is connected with everything else. So rather like, we say, like bramble bushes in a thicket, if you tug one bush, you don't know what's going to happen elsewhere. Yeah. So that's called entanglement. And that's not quantum entanglement. It's entanglement at the level of nature. Yeah. Now, a metaphor for those type of three systems is solid, liquid, and gas. And actually, they go through phase shifts. So if I heat up water to 100 degrees, it doesn't become steam immediately. I have to put more heat in before it makes a change. That's called latent heat. So order, complex, and chaos are phase shift differences. Something is distinctly one or the other, and energy gets put in or energy gets taken out to make the shift between them. Right, so that's my three fundamental ones. And if you go back to your high school physics, you'll know about the triple point, which is there's a balance between pressure and temperature, which is equiprobable, whether something will become solid, liquid, or gas. So in Canavin, that's called the confused domain. And in CLEAR, the relationship between cause and effect is self-evident to any reasonable person. So in Germany, you drive on the right. In Britain, we drive on the left. Yeah. So it's obvious what you should do. Whereas in the complicated domain, it's knowable to experts, but it's not immediately obvious to a non-expert. So that's kind of like an artificial distinction, but that's useful. So fundamentally, Canavin has five domains. Yeah, clear, complicated, complex, chaotic, and confused. And there's other aspects to it, that, but its fundamental principle is you do different things based on which domain you're in.
So the fundamental reasoning is for sense-making. I guess the Quinarium framework has a vast applicability and is not dependable on the context in which it is applied.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's used extensively in military decision making. It's actually in the manuals of most of the American and the Swedish armed forces and also the British. At the same time, it's used in the development sector to understand different modes of evaluation. Yeah. There's a paper written by somebody in the British cabinet about they use Canavin to explain the role of religion in the White House in America. I'm quite fond of that article. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in the medical profession and elsewhere. So it's become, I think Canavin comes from natural science. So it's got multiple applications. It's not just a construct based on a few case studies. It's actually what we call theory-based practice. So it developed from theory and was applied in practice. It didn't start with observations of what other groups of people had done.
And this is the beauty of the Canavian framework, this chameleontic applicability in a multitude of sectors.
And it's, I mean, the sort of process we describe in the EU field guide on complexity management is fairly simple. In a crisis, you're in chaos, everything is all over the place. Your job as a leader is to rapidly impose order, but what you really want to do is to move into that confused domain. And at that point, we call it aporetic. Aporia means a set of paradoxes you can't resolve, because then you can decide where things go. So you can give things to experts in a complicated domain. If it's complex, you can do parallel experiments. If it's still chaotic, you can start to use wisdom of crowds, mass sense, to see possibilities. So it's that ability to avoid a linear one-size-fits-all process and choose the right things to do in context.
And to your last point, how do we go about breaking down the system? How do we proceed forward from analyzing the context and making a decision and choosing the right people within a specific domain, you know, the chaotic, the simple, the complicated, or the complex?
Well, there's methods around this, all right? So one of the ways Canavian is often defined is by stories from the organization's history. But we've also, for example, frequently used films to define it because it's an abstraction. I mean, one of the ways I try and explain complexity to people is say, go and watch Frozen 2. If you haven't seen Frozen 2, which is a Disney version, there's this lovely phrase from Elsa in it, do the next right thing. That's actually a really good illustration of complexity. You can't know what to do in the future, so you do the next right thing and you look again. So the basic heuristic for a complex system is the evidence available to you as a decision maker supports conflicting hypotheses about what you should do. And you can't resolve which is right on an evidence base in the time available for a decision. Now that means it's complex. So instead of trying to do it, you do a safe to fail experiment in each of the coherent hypotheses and see what happens. So in complexity, you're constantly experimenting in parallel with contradictory theories to make sure you don't miss things. And as things evolve, you get there. Ordered systems, they're predictable. That's not difficult.
Let me see if I understood correctly. So firstly, there is a generation of hypotheses of what something could be. And then as you move forward, you get more informations and then you iterate on these and you iterate on your decisions and you adjust, adapt, or maintain that decision as you proceed.
Yeah, but not on a single process. You don't want to do a single iterative process because you bias the system by how you start. You do parallel initiation from different perspectives. So if you're a senior executive, you might have five teams, who basically think each other are fundamentally wrong, but they work in parallel. And by the way, that's a significant conflict resolution technique. Because if I've got five teams who all think they've got the solution, all we have to agree is the other team's solutions are coherent. We can say they're wrong, but they're coherent. They've got some validity, at which point we do the experiments and we see what happens. We don't force conflict up front.
So that's fascinating, using contradictory theory alongside a parallel exploratory and iterative process to come up to alternative solutions as well and mitigate bias. There's another aspect that you talk about within the Canavian framework. There are type of reasonings, and you talk about deduction, induction, and abduction. I'm a very fan of abduction as I use it in my PhD research as well in innovation management and how abduction could enhance decision making. How do you frame those three reasoning within the Canavian framework?
I think abduction is key. So fundamentally, in a complex space, you're into abductive logic, not inductive logic. I mean, you very rarely get deduction in a human system. You're nearly always inductive. And virtually everything that you see in the sort of popular management books is based on cases. So it assumes repetition. That's the inductive approach. All the companies who are successful have CEOs who play golf. So if we train our CEO to play golf, we will be successful. I mean, that's the correlation confusion example, right? But it doesn't mean there isn't validity in saying all these successful companies, you know, pay attention to cash. That's more sensible. You just got to be careful about what you do, right? Mm-hmm. The trouble is, in a complex system, the same thing isn't going to happen again in the same way twice.
Mm-hmm.
So by definition, an approach based on cases is fundamentally a mistake because the cases won't repeat. And that's where we move into abduction, which is also known as the logic of hunches. So, for example, one of the things we've developed is the ability to present a situation to the whole of your workforce. The workforce interpret that in real time in ways that they can't game. The non-gameability is key. Yeah. And from that, we draw maps called a fitness landscape in complexity theory. Yeah. And it shows dominant views, minority views, but it also shows outlier views. And as a leader, you need to pay attention to that. So there's a famous set of experiments which illustrate this point. A group of radiologists are given a batch of x-rays and asked to look for anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
And on the final x-ray, you put a picture of a gorilla in plain sight, which is 48 times the size of a cancer nodule. And on average, 83% of radiologists don't see it. And the 70% who do see it come to believe they were wrong when they talk with the 83%. So one of the processes of abductive search is to find the 17%. And the big problem I got set when I was working for DARPA in the US on counterterrorism, and this is by a former national security advisor who headed the project. And he said, how do you make objective insight? How do you make abductive insight objective?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the history of counterterrorism, somebody always spots in advance the thing that with the benefit of hindsight, you wish you paid attention to. And that's what I worked on for 5 years, and that's what I've just described, is the ability to say which of those weak signals are significant. And that's really important. And people neglect abduction.
I read previously about this experiment, and I found very intriguing how people acknowledge the gorilla hindsight, but when they were being shown those photos, those images, and they didn't know about the gorilla, they couldn't come up with actually, oh yeah, there is a gorilla. It is very hard, very, very difficult to spot it actually. So that's maybe why people neglect abduction and don't appreciate its functionality.
It's impossible. That's the point. It's impossible. Yeah, it's not that you can be, the only people who will always see the gorilla are fully autistic.
Mm.
And they can't cope with the information load. So we evolved to make decisions using about 5% of the available information, privileged on our most recent experiences, and that's how we make decisions. So this is what we call a naturalizing approach to sense-making. We say we know from natural science that you will scan 3 or 4%, you'll fuse memory patterns, and then you'll act on the first pattern which fits. So if we know that, and we know that you won't see things you're not expecting to see, we build systems to make them visible. We don't try and train you to do what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different sort of approach.
Basically, we're biased by our prior knowledge.
I mean, Gary Klein makes this point, and I agree with him, that there's no such thing as a cognitive bias. They're actually cognitive heuristics.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution doesn't throw out things which don't have utility. They allow, actually, as a species, us to make decisions very quickly. So they're heuristics, not biases, but they're part of what we are as a species. So we need to work with them rather than try and pretend we can remove them.
Yeah, so to this point, and taking also a Kuhnevian approach to bias as well, because we know that we don't spot the gorilla in images, can we actually, you know, pause for a second our perception of we know that we don't see the gorilla and try to actually look for that in some ways?
No, you can't and you shouldn't, because 99.9% of the time you haven't got time. You're making decisions about, you know, before an operation. Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, the way I normally describe it, all right, if you think about the early hominoids on the savannas of Africa, something large and yellow with very sharp teeth runs towards you at high speed. Do you want to autistically scan all available data, look up a catalogue of the animals of Africa, and having identified lion, look up best practice case studies on how to avoid being eaten by lions? Yeah, by the time you get there, the only book of any use to you is the book of Jonah from the Old Testament, which is the only example I've found of how to escape from the digestive tract of a large carnivore. Yeah. So we evolve to make decisions very, very quickly, and most of the time it works for the best. Now, the abductive approach I talked to you is to find the people who are seeing something that you're not seeing. Remember, 17% actually see the gorilla. So making that visible before they talk to the 83% is key, and that's what we do with things like mass sense. Right, to make another point on this, which is important, human beings evolved for clan-type sense-making, not for individual sense-making. Yeah? So within a group of people, somebody will always see the gorilla. Right? So you have to find ways in which you pay attention to that. You can't get everybody to see the gorilla, because if so, they wouldn't do what else they meant to do. And there's all sorts of human constructs around that. But we have really evolved for groups of about 150 people in a hunter-gathering environment. And that's where our cognitive power comes from. It's from collective sense-making. It's not from individual sense-making. And the massive mistake in Northern Europe and North America, and of course that informs nearly all management theory, is to assume the primary unit is the individual. It isn't. It's actually the collective and the links between people that matter, not the people.
So then it is important for the rest that don't see the gorilla to actually understand that these people that saw the gorillas are actually saying something that they saw, and they're not just came up with something crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, you can do, there's another version on this by which you show six kids, three in white and three in black, playing with the basket, two basketballs, and you ask them to count the number of times they pass the basketball. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the film, a woman in a gorilla suit walks into the middle and beats her chest and walks out, and hardly anybody see it. And they don't believe it was there when you tell them afterwards. They don't believe it because they didn't see it. And that's the problem. All right. So what you have to do is to make it visible. We do that with digital representation. So here's an outlier, go and talk. These people see it differently from you. All right. So you've got to get, and there's an old thing on this. When I was a kid, all right, we used to get these picture books. Mm-hmm. It would have a sort of line drawing of a municipal park. And it would say, in this park, there are hidden 10 kitchen utensils. And they'd be hidden in the foliage. And because you knew there were 10 kitchen utensils, you found them. But if you just said anything unusual in this picture, you wouldn't. Right? Now, this is called attentional triggering, which we do a lot of work on. You have to trigger people to know that there's something that they should look for. Yeah, and you can't afford to do that too often. You know, there's no legend about crying wolf. Yeah, that's if you trigger it too often and people don't find something of consequences, they'll stop looking anyway.
And who are the players involved in this reasoning process?
I think it's a mixture. Nothing's ever that simple. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the field guide is that you distribute decision-making in centralized coordination. So in a crisis, you can't afford to be making decisions in the center. This is one of the big mistakes governments have made on vaccine rollouts and things like that. Which actually Britain didn't do. They decentralized the decision process. Yeah, so the decision about how to roll out was being made on a highly decentralized basis. The center only coordinated, and that works. All right. So one of the things you're doing is, as a leader, I mean, you learn this. I've been a C-level executive most of my life, all right? The more you get promoted, two things happen, yeah? One is you only meet angrier and angrier customers. So happy customers never come to see you. It's only angry customers you see. All right. The second thing is that you learn you can't make many decisions because the decisions, you know, you haven't got attention to the detail. And if you're good, you learn to coordinate and ask questions and connect people. And you learn not to make decisions. And that's a key function. So if you do that, you're going to find weak signals fast. Yeah. And then you can pay attention.
Then it is more of a bottom-up approach to decision-making. You're still making the decision at the executive level, but the information comes from the bottom and the community.
You may not, actually. You may allow the decisions to be fully distributed. It's actually fractal. It's self-similar. Mm-hmm. It's neither bottom-up or top-down. It's like when we do change, all right? So this is fractal. This is vector theory of change. We present data to say, let's suppose we're trying to change attitudes to customers, all right? So we gather customer stories in a quantifiable form. And we go to, say, a department and say, how would you create more customer stories like these and fewer customer stories like those? Now, that's a non-threatening question. If you say, how do you improve customer satisfaction? People will say they're doing it. Yeah. But then that data gets aggregated at an executive level and you say to the board, what can you as a board do to create more stories like this and fewer stories like that? So everybody is making a decision about something which they can do directly tomorrow rather than talking about what other people should do. And that's called fractal intervention. Yeah. It also means different parts of the organization can go in different directions because they're in different starting points.
And this also merges with system theory and system thinking?
No. Well, I mean, systems thinking is on this sort of, well, you've got a problem, all right, in that if you look at the origins of complexity theory, things like cybernetics and systems dynamics is a very small part of the origin. Most of the origins is physics, biology. It comes from the natural sciences, right? You have got a view on systems thinking, which is sort of promiscuous in that anything which talks about systems, they want to call systems thinking. I think that becomes meaningless. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So the key distinction for me is complexity theory deals with systems which don't have linear causality. And that's so important that you can't homogenize it with things like Beer's VSM model or Checkland's material. I think the other thing that you also learn from complexity is you have to scale to large volume. And nearly all of systems thinking, that includes Mike Jackson's critical systems thinking, which is one of the more progressive ones, they still depend on getting people in a workshop and talking about things. And that doesn't scale, and it's too subject to bias based on the facilitator's attitude. So in complexity theory, we're trying to work at very high scale, getting rid of workshops as much as possible, using visualization, using distributed decision-making. Yeah, so it's a different field. The other way I often describe, I mean, people often say this, they say, well, you know, systems thinking, we've been working on complexity for a long time. And the answer is, yes, you have. Yeah. Yeah. People built canals with lock gates before Newton discovered gravity. But now we've got the science. So the fact you studied it is one thing and you found some really good methods and we can reuse those. But now we actually know the science of uncertainty. Yeah. And so it's like when Newton discovered the laws of gravity, or, you know, if you look at the discovery of quantum mechanics, once you've got a science to understand the phenomena, you're into a different position. And that's why I don't like being homogenized under systems thinking, but I have a huge respect for a lot of the methods which emerge from it.
Okay. Another interesting point.
This, by the way, is very controversial in social media at the moment.
What the
I'm being attacked by cybernetics. Well, there's a whole bunch of cybernetics guys who are feeling very threatened by this. All right? I call them the cybernetics fanboys.
About the contradiction between system and complexity?
No, I think the trouble is you got people in cybernetics basically think they got complexity sorted. And they haven't, all right? Cybernetics was a really good post-hoc explanation of complex phenomena before we had the science. Yeah, but we don't need that anymore. We can, I mean, you know, VSM we don't need. Beer's original work, yes, we can use that, yeah? Akoff, interestingly, is a good transition. Akoff is almost a complexity thinker. He just didn't have the science. Yeah, so this is respect the past, but don't be bound by it.
Yeah, and it's like using uncertainties and getting more information and change your, as you before said, in parallel, do iterative process in parallel, not just one. As we know more, yeah, we should adjust and adapt what we've done before. There's another aspect that I really like it. We talk actually, I sent you a LinkedIn message maybe last year or 2 years ago about sidecasting and not just backcasting. Yeah. You introduced this word of sidecasting. I found it fascinating. Yeah. Can we elaborate more on this?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at the history of development, you have forecasting, which projects forward from the present. And then you get a group of people who decided that was too depressing. Now, I find it rather odd. If it's depressing, maybe you should try and do something about it. But they said, what we'll do is we'll backcast. Yeah. And this gets heavily picked up by people like Peter Senge and the systems dynamics guys. So what you do is you say where I would like to be, and then you work backwards to say how I can achieve that. Yeah. Now, from a complexity point of view, that's a mistake because you haven't got a causal chain. Mm-hmm. So you're going to miss, you know, if you do it that way, you're in complexity, we start journeys. So side casting is you cast around in the present, yeah, to find what's possible, and then you do the experimental moves. Yeah, so that's casting around. And it gives me this wonderful metaphor of the fly fisherman. Yeah, you don't know where the fish are, so you have to cast around until something bites, then you move forward. Then you move forward.
And that basically gives you more adaptability and flexibility. It gives you a wider range of options.
It does. And I think the key phrase we say, this is another difference between systems thinking and complexity thinking. System thinking tends to define the goal. Systems thinking doesn't want complexity thinking doesn't want to have goals because they're dangerous. So it starts journeys with a sense of direction. Then you can discover novelty on the pathway. Right? And that is a key distinction. And in a crisis, that's even more important. Yeah, because the other thing you're going to have to do is, you know, one of the big things we do is to do knowledge mapping. So we map what we know at the right level of granularity that we can radically repurpose it for novel use. And that's a key human capability. Yeah, it's called acceptation in biology. So the ability to rapidly repurpose and adjust and change direction is key. Yeah, in a VUCA world, to use the jargon. Yeah, you can't afford to have too many plans because then you get too committed to the plans and then things start to go wrong. And by the way, that's the other reason why the central decision maker doesn't make decisions. Because in a crisis, most of the decision is going to be wrong. So you want somebody else to make them. Yeah. And that's not being cynical, that's necessary. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you on that. And, I have a feeling that this links back to what we said before about the gorilla, because, you know, as we move in complexity, we don't have goal, but we are open for novelty and emergence. So we need to understand and learn how to spot this novelty and emergence as we go.
Can you pay attention in different ways? So take a walking example, because you also walk, right? So last weekend, we were finally allowed back onto mountains. I can't go into Wales because the border is closed. I always thought I'd be on the other side of the border when that happened, but I'm not. So there's one mountain in the Brecon Beacons, which is actually in England. So we went up it, yeah? And most of the time we're working along a path. So at that point, you look far ahead, you're having conversations, you're paying attention in a different way. And then we have the guy who created the route, he doesn't like paths. So we have a phrase, he says, let's turn right through to the heather. At which point you dread what's going to happen, because now you've got a kilometre of walking over PTAG without a track where you're at risk of, you know, breaking your ankle at any moment. And all of a sudden you're entirely paying attention to your feet and your feet placement, yeah, and playing resilient. So you're paying attention to things in a different way because you've had that physical stimulation of change. Now, the problem is in most corporate decision making, we don't make those ritual transitions. Yeah, we carry on the way we were making decisions. We don't change fast enough. So a lot of our works is actually using ritual to trigger people to pay attention to different things. Yeah.
So speaking of work, what's the latest project you're working on now?
We've got a pilot project which is just starting on peace and reconciliation in the States after the election. That's using a narrative-based method, and that's designed to get people to focus on micro problems from both sides, so they have a different sort of discourse. So that's really exciting at the moment. For the EU field guide, I'm just finishing off tonight the assessment process, so that an organization can map what they did against the field guide and decide where they go next. And we got the pilot projects already set up for that, so I'll be working on those next week. So yeah, that's quite exciting.
Awesome. And before we go, I think we said a lot, and there is a lot to digest for the listener on, you know, for what you shared. What's the latest book or the book you are reading at the moment?
Okay, so two. I've just finished a book which is fascinating, called The History of the World According to Sheep. And from a complexity specialist point of view, it's brilliant because it just shows how many things we depend on for sheep. Yeah, including their role in the sex industry. And it's, just read it, all right? It's absolutely fascinating in terms of the detail. Yeah, it's sort of man's oldest synergy. The one I'm just about to start to read is Helgoland from Carlo Rovelli. So I just picked that up from the bookshop, and I've got about halfway through that. Yeah. So this is the history of quantum mechanics.
Wow, there is a lot also to read on those two books. I think I'm gonna get the first one you mentioned, and then I move into quantum mechanics.
That's just fun, all right. But the history, the sheep one is brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. Thank you so much. I mean, it's been a wonderful, insightful. And again, a lot of information to digest. So thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks a lot.
The briefing today unplugs people's creativity by embracing the wonder of change. It seeks inspiration from maverick innovators and change makers to share their stories, experiences, and dreams.